Right, so where to draw the line? So it's submitted that the expert planning evidence of Paul Thomas best captured what an ordinary person would understand to be within the scope of a railway network or utility operation, and that's his written evidence. His evidence is that the railway operation would include loading and unloading wagons, marshalling freight to and from the railway line, and unloading and unloading vehicles for inbound and outbound freight, but that warehousing, distributing and processing the freight would be outside the scope of a railway operation. Taking...
Just on that idea, though, virtually all of the sites that I have seen, the logs are being warehoused and distributed. So logging, which is a fundamental core operation, is being warehoused and distributed.
Yes, and I thought you might ask me that as well, sir. I went to quite extensive lengths to try and figure out how that worked on the centre port port activities next to the railway line, and I'm afraid that my caution as to historic uses in development of the land is going to be something that is going to apply there. There's no reference in their material that I could find to how the logging activities or operation was provided for next to it. What I will say is that obviously I've looked into this issue, but I haven't been able to sit through all the evidence. I haven't been able to call other experts in support of this, so I am dependent on the observations of others, and I understand that you've discussed this with quite a few of KiwiRail's experts and also Mr. Thomas, and I'm going to need to be quite guided by what he says here. I don't have an intricate knowledge of loading and railway operations to fall back on. But the warehousing, in my submission, the warehousing, distribution and processing of the freight is outside what you would normally consider to be a railway operation, and certainly you wouldn't think of that if you saw the word railway lines. Taking KiwiRail's list, and this is again reliant on the evidence of Paul Thomas, of the key elements associated with works for the freight hub, his view is that the following four aspects may to some extent be outside the scope of a railway operation. He's identified the container terminals only cover container terminals or container terminal yards to the extent that they're required for loading and unloading of railway wagons and road vehicles. And again, in relation to logging, I'm not sure how long those logs stay stored on some of those other sites. The loading and devanning of containers is a separate aspect that's outside the scope of railway network utility operation. The freight forwarding facilities, these are only within scope of the network utility operation if they're for loading and unloading of freight by KiwiRail. Designation can't authorise freight forwarding activities by KiwiRail's freight forwarding partners, for example, at private sidings. And I'd add that it, to the extent that I understand, it doesn't appear to make much difference as to whether these are level one or level two. It's who's undertaking those activities. The notice of requirement for designation cannot lawfully be confirmed to the extent it seeks to cover KiwiRail granting leases or licences to freight forwarding partners or customers or authorises use of private sidings. It's hard to see how they can maintain financial responsibility for these aspects. More generally, a designation can only authorise land uses and activities undertaken by the requiring authority, and we've seen that in Section 176, not by other persons. Log handling yards. These are only within the scope of network utility operation to the extent they're for the unloading and loading of logs from rail wagons. It's submitted it would be outside the scope for the designation to cover, say, processing, such as fumigants, debarking and spitting, but also there's a question mark around long-term storage. Bulk liquid storage. Mr. Thomas's view is that temporary storage of bulk liquids that would have been or will be transported by rail is within the scope of the railway network operation. However, again, long-term storage or warehousing of liquids is out of scope. In terms of another category, buildings and other ancillary activities to the freight hub, such as offices and buildings and car parking, and mitigation works such as stormwater ponds and noise bunds, weren't commented on by Mr. Thomas. But again, the acceptability of these items will depend on the extent they're required for activities that are in or out of scope. In conclusion, the panel needs to carefully regard the scope of KiwiRail's approval as a requiring authority for the operation of its rail network utility operation. If the panel is to recommend confirmation of the notice of requirement, then it should recommend precise wording as to what activities are within scope of the designation. And just looking at the 6 August conditions, you'll see that the council has actually set out some definitions up front with some very useful, I guess, very, very useful suggestions that KiwiRail fill in to, so you can know what the scope of the activities are. And at the moment, we don't have that list, so it's very difficult to comment. They're just simply undefined terms at this point. I would just say that the older approach to designation, for example, simply referring to railway purposes with no elaboration, is not appropriate when KiwiRail is seeking a new designation to cover a range of activities. The modern approach to designations is to provide for the precise wording as to the scope of the designation. The panel should also very carefully assess whether the full area of land proposed for the designation is necessary for the activities that are within the scope of KiwiRail's approval as a requiring authority. If it agrees that KiwiRail's intermodal freight includes land required for activities that exceed that scope, it follows that the designation process is unavailable for those elements of the proposal and cannot be granted. KiwiRail does have other options. It can always seek a private plan change or resource consent for those components of the project, and that's the usual way that these sorts of things proceed. What is difficult in this case is, and I don't think it's an easy question for the panel to grapple with, KiwiRail set out to develop an intermodal freight hub. It's been very clear about that. If that exceeds its powers, then Ms. Paulson, Mr. Miles explain in their evidence, KiwiRail has scoped its activities based on those components that it needed to identify to develop an intermodal freight hub. And this feed into the master plan, the development of its project objectives, its alternative assessment, and its site selection, resulting in KiwiRail's notice of requirement, AEE, and evidence. The error is apparent from the outset, so it becomes quite difficult to untangle. It follows the consideration would need to be given as to the extent of the out-of-scope components of the project have tainted or infected these decisions and assessments of the remaining aspects of the proposal, and that is absolutely no easy task. Moving on from scope, another issue that has arisen is the integration with the future traffic network. KiwiRail, in applying for the notice of requirement in advance of the roading projects required in the vicinity to provide for efficient transport of freight to and from the freight hub via road. The following roading projects are necessary. So the Palmerston North Integrated Traffic Improvement Projects, which include the Regional Freight Ring Road, and Palmerston North City Council's roading requirements identified in the long-term community plan that appear to have provision for funding. KiwiRail has acknowledged that the projects are not a part of the existing environment in a Hawthorne sense, and they're not yet part of the existing environment, including the reasonably foreseeable future environment, as they have not been confirmed, applied for, or approved, and are dependent on future processes. However, in respect of the projects outlined in B, this is the long-term plan projects, both Council and KiwiRail's traffic experts agree they should be considered as part of the future traffic environment. And my question simply is whether that's If that's correct, will depend on whether Palmerston North City Council has obtained roading designations or resource consents for these works, or if those are necessary. Council for Kiwi Rail in opening, and Ms Bell in her evidence, has agreed that it's inappropriate to consider the effect of future roading projects, and the panel must determine whether the project alone meets the Act's sustainable purpose as a standalone proposal. Kiwi Rail has confirmed that the notice of requirement has been designed to function without these projects. And I'll just note that the correct approach was discussed in Basin Bridge, and that's the standalone as is, without consideration of those. As noted by Ms Fraser, this approach has been muddied by Kiwi Rail's objective.
Can I just read this, please, this section? Can you just give me your reference for the proposition at paragraph 58? You may have to come back to me, but...
Yes, absolutely. I'll come back to you with the answer for that. As noted by Ms Fraser, this approach has been muddied by Kiwi Rail's Objective 2, which aimed at integrating and connecting rail with other transport nodes and networks. Kiwi Rail's discussion of how notice of requirement achieves this placed considerable reliance on the future of Waka Kotahi's North Integrated Improvement Project, Regional Freight Ring Road. It's difficult to see how this objective can be met without considering future roading proposals, which in turn cannot be considered. As noted in the officer's report, the freight hub will enable rail to be connected to the modes and networks, but not always in an efficient way. And suboptimal integration would risk undermining Kiwi Rail's other objectives for the project. The impact of future roading proposals is particularly relevant when considering the stated positive effects of the freight hub. The claimed positive effects of the freight hub being regional growth, increased employment opportunities, increase in capacity and efficiency of the rail network, transportation network, reduced cost, reduction of carbon, and increased efficiency in road and rail, are all heavily dependent upon future roading projects, the development of an efficient integrated transport network to realise those benefits. The relationship between the future roading improvements and positive economic effects is unclear in Mr Colgrave's evidence. He quantifies the economic benefits of the freight hub, the importance to Palmerston North and the wider economy. Nowhere in his description of economic benefits of the proposal, including estimates as to the economic benefit associated with full operation of the freight hub, does he acknowledge or mention the important role of the Palmerston North PIMT works to unlock those benefits? Mr Paling has also provided evidence for Kiwi Rail as to the economic effects of the proposal, including transport efficiency, benefits, economic drivers for well-integrated and connected road and rail transport. Like Mr Colgrave, he's included assessments of growth and benefits associated with the hub when fully operational. While Mr Palin goes into considerable detail about transport efficiency and the reduction of cost moving freight, rail freight and integration and connectivity to the hub and wider transport network when he makes his assessment of the benefits arising from road and rail, he too fails to mention the necessary future PIMT works to facilitate successful integration of the road and rail and transport efficiency. The difficulty with the claimed positive effects of the proposal was commented on by the Section 42 report, based on Mr Villatich's concern that the positive effects were overstated. He says the achievement of these positive effects is heavily reliant on the freight hub being well connected and integrated with the wider transport network and other economic activities in the northeast of the city. Ms Bell elsewhere in her evidence has acknowledged the importance of these works in relationship with the freight hub to the extent that the economic witnesses do not, in the context of discussing lapse periods. Ms Bell says the delivery of the PIMT programme of works will be important to enable benefits of the freight hub to be fully realised and become fully operational. In my submission, this is an important concession. Nowhere else does KiwiRail acknowledged that unlocking the claimed positive benefits of the proposal is contingent on those roading works. It's entirely absent from the economic assessment of the positive economic effects of the proposal. The strong correlation between integrated network Pimpty Works and the success of the freight hub has not been fully acknowledged in those statements or assessments. Mr. Vuletic's evidence is that the efficient connections between the freight hub and the existing future roading network is the other essential component to maximising potential economic benefits of the freight hub. In my submission, a serious question arises as to whether the panel can properly assess the claimed environmental benefits and costs of the project, given that full recognition of those positive benefits is contingent on other proposals that have not been approved. There's a risk that these have been overstated or may not be capable of being achieved, and we all know many examples of roading projects that have been advanced at particular times and then haven't occurred. KiwiRail should be required to confirm what the positive effects of the project are as is, and that's without the future integration. In terms of the effects assessment, Drs. Whittles and Fox adopt the legal submissions made by Mr. Slyfield on behalf of Peter Gall and Dale O'Reilly in their entirety. KiwiRail's approach to the notice of requirement lacks sufficient detail to the extent it's impossible to determine what those effects might be. It falls short of what's required to enable the Council's experts panel and those affected to understand the scale and significance of the various effects and engage in those in a meaningful way. The scenarios discussed by Mr. Slyfield in relation to construction, operational noise and visual amenity illustrate this point and are equally applicable to my clients and many others. KiwiRail has taken a selective approach to the assessment of the project. Best practice requires that the level of detail should correspond with the severity of the effect. It's also inconsistent with the Section 3 definition of effects in the Act. Construction noise and construction traffic haven't been modelled, and little attempt has been made to quantify these, despite likelihood of significant effects, including temporary, albeit long-term effects. Cumulative acoustic and vibration effects of the notice of requirement have not, or I couldn't find anywhere where these had actually been set out and considered. These are defined as any cumulative effect which arises over time in combination with other effects, regardless of the scale of intensity, duration, or frequency of the effect. There's no mention of the cumulative effects of construction noise, intermodal freight hub operational noise, noise generated by trains, construction operational traffic. There does appear to be quite a compartmentalised approach, and I haven't been able to find anywhere where these are sufficiently set out to be able to add it all up. But compartmentalising these activities provides no protection for affected properties who will be subjected to significant noise at high levels simultaneously, because these activities will occur, or they have to occur, all together. And there's not a construction period that is set and then operation would occur. Like, there's construction that will occur at various stages throughout the life of the freight hub while other activities are operating. There don't appear to be any periods for when construction ends and operations start. The definition of operation excludes key activities. The panel cannot rely on the New Zealand standards, such as construction or operational noise, as providing a reasonable level of protection, which, you know, you usually should be able to, because the conditions provide and expect those limits to be breached, and there's no upper limit identified in the acoustic conditions for both construction noise and operational noise. It's just a trigger for further assessment or identification as requiring acoustic treatment or notification. I haven't been able to find that top upper limit where it has to stop. Operational noise is also said to exclude operational train noise or vibration, or presumably increased use of the North Island main trunk as a result of the freight hub. Dr. Charles identifies this as a legal issue, but I haven't been able to find it identified, wasn't discussed in KiwiRail's council's opening, and Palmerston North Council has not yet addressed this. It's very difficult, without those explanations, to see what the legal basis for excluding acoustic effects of train usage of the NIMT is. The relocation of parts of the NIMT line is proposed as part of the notice of requirement for the freight hub. Outside those existing designation, Dr. Childs clearly claims the benefits. He says there's acoustic benefits from the relocation of the NIMT as a result of the freight hub, and he claims these in his evidence as positive effects of the project, but he excludes the adverse effects. In my submission, KiwiRail shouldn't have it both ways. Mr. Lloyd's concerns are supported here. Trains are expected to increase the frequency as a result of the freight hub. Rail is a key component to the freight hub, and therefore acoustic and vibration effects of the rail operation, including the relocated NIMT, should rightly be considered and assessed as part of the effects of the notice of requirement and the existing NIMT as a cumulative effect in conjunction with other noise effects. Another example is that KiwiRail has failed to undertake an assessment of cultural effects. Again, it's difficult to see how the panel can ensure that its decision will have, shall recognise and provide for those matters in 6E and have particular regard to 7A and AA or consider Section 8. In my submission, KiwiRail's recommended condition for identification of the effects of the notice of identification of cultural effects after the notice requirement has been confirmed doesn't and cannot replace the need for the panel to understand what those effects are and take them into account now. It can't abdicate its responsibilities to decide what level of adverse effects are appropriate over a whole range of issues. KiwiRail's experts have also wrongly dismissed Council's concerns regarding deficiencies in the information on ecological, stormwater, natural hazards, waterways and dust effects on the basis that they'll be the subject of regional consents. Just like to note that the effects assessment is a mandatory part of the Notice of Requirement application. Section 1682 requires KiwiRail to give notice of its requirement in the prescribed form, and on that form it states that an application for Notice of Requirement should include the effects that the work that the public work or project work will have on the environment and the ways in which any adverse effects will be mitigated. There's a bit of a question in my mind whether we know what those effects are or how they can be mitigated. Consideration of effects of the proposal was a focal point and it's front and centre to the panel's inquiry at section 1713. When considering a requirement and submissions received, a territorial authority must, subject to Part 2, consider the effects on the environment following the requirement. It's submitted that there's no ability in Section 171 for the panel to defer the consideration of effects to an ODP. Effects are a crucial plank of the decision-making function in Section 1714. The panel must also consider Part 2 matters. The mandatory direction, does not allow the panel to disregard consideration of those Part 2 matters that may be the subject of future regional consents or ignore the regional planning network framework entirely. The statute does not say that. It actually says quite the opposite. Section 1713A3 and 4 directs the panel to have particular regard to operative and proposed regional policy statements and plans, national policy statements and environmental standards. These are matters that need to be considered. Conditions may be imposed by the panel at 1712C, including to avoid, remedy or mitigate an effect of the notice of requirement. There's no restrictions on conditions imposed on a designation. It's not subject to Section 108 in relation to resource consent conditions. But practically, a condition for a designation should be for a resource management purpose, be fairly and reasonably related to the proposed work, not be unreasonable, have to be certain, not require third-party action, not be discretionary and or delegate power to make or colour further recommendations, and not defeat the designation. Conditions imposed must correspond to an identifiable effect, and the panel must have confidence and certainty that the condition can address those effects. The panel cannot delegate its decision-making function or pass that responsibility on by imposing conditions such as proposed Condition 58 and 79 that direct KiwiRail to avoid, remedy or mitigate an identified effect which in all likelihood hasn't been identified yet. The frequency of such conditions are also evidence that there's an insufficient understanding of the effects. There's very few hard limits provided in the 6 August conditions, and that was the latest I could find on the website, so my apologies if they've been superseded. I know the council officers have been working on them. It is difficult to reconcile these with the Category A, B and C assessments that have been contained in Dr. Child's evidence. Mr. Lloyd's comments that the acoustic assessment is nothing more than a virtual placeholder for future assessments does ring true. None of the New Zealand standards, use of the New Zealand standards, including the NES, has been watered down by language not used in the standards, such as best practical and objective or key noise sources excluded. The upper limit of the construction noise standards and operational noise standards are treated as soft limits, triggering further conditions that themselves have no hard upper limit, restricting noise emitted from the freight hub. Section 176A provides for an outline plan to be provided at the construction stage. Unlike outline plans that have been sort of poo-hooed by the Environment Court by private applicants, the designation process enables a statutory pathway to continue to use them. When application, so you can apply for an outline development plan provided at the construction stage when additional information is available. However, it must be understood that territorial authorities cannot impose conditions on an outline plan. A territorial authority can only request changes to the plan, which KiwiRail doesn't necessarily need to accept. Thus, it's usually more appropriate to attach conditions to the designation to provide a framework for preparing and considering an outline plan of works. There is no subsequent ability for a council to refuse or recommend that an outline development plan be withdrawn or conditions of a notice requirement altered if there's a later disagreement about the extent of effects or appropriateness of mitigation. And in that case as well, most importantly, there'd be no recourse for the community. Based on the conditions proposed, it is very difficult to demonstrate what non-compliance would actually look like. In order to reach a decision and impose conditions designed to manage effects of the notice of requirement via a future ODP, the panel needs to be very confident that they have a full understanding of the receiving environment and extent of the effects of the notice of requirement. KiwiRail will depend on a raft of management plans to address effects. Although a management plan can provide information as to how the parameters or controls are achieved, it's inappropriate for those controls to be left to the management plan. That was set out by the Environment Court and Wood v West Regional Council. In the end, Council were agreed on a submission by Ms Robinson that a management plan can be required to be prepared pursuant to Section 108(3) of the Act, but its purpose should be to provide consent authority and anyone else that might be interested with information about the way the consent holder intends to comply with the more specific controls or parameters laid down by the conditions. And admittedly, this is on a consent application or designation, but in my submission it's relevant here. But the way in which these are complied with is for the consent holder, who will be required to provide a management plan containing information about the method of compliance. Now, if the panel accept that there's a particular measure necessary to protect, say, amenity or reduced effects, or ensure that effects are reduced to an acceptable level, it is requested that the panel ensure that these are provided in the condition as hard limits, including to control future effects of the freight hub, such as the discussion of Dr. Chile's in relation to restricting nighttime noise. Yes, they may be able to, but they won't have to unless it's provided for in a condition. Retain indoor or outdoor amenity, recognise and protect a range of noise-sensitive areas. Yes, the evidence does discuss a range of mitigation measures that are possible, but unless it's provided in a condition, there's no expectation that there's certainty there that will occur or ensure that it's enforceable. KiwiRail have opted to take an envelope approach to the notice of requirement. While focusing much of their evidence on suggested possible mitigations, these aren't reflected in the proposed conditions. The danger in this approach is that it will solidify upper limits or worst-case scenario effects, or no upper limits, and once established, these will very quickly become design parameters. There's no incentive to reduce these further, and there's absolutely no onus on KiwiRail to do so. The permitted baseline. There's some dispute between Council and KiwiRail as to whether the permission baseline should apply or not. Relevant section of section 104.2 of the RMA provides, when forming an opinion on subsection 1, a consent authority may disregard an adverse effect of the activity on the environment if a national environmental standard or plan permits that activity with that effect. Where applicable, this allows adverse effects contemplated by the plan to be disregarded. However, there's no equivalent provisions for designations. The court in Beadle accepted that the permitted baseline could apply for designations. However, the application of the permitted baseline is at the panel's discretion. It's not mandatory, and there's no case law or statute requiring its application. If applied, panels should be aware that the permitted baseline would operate to reduce the adverse effects of the notice of requirement under consideration, and that's been observed by the Court of Appeal in Far District North Council case, where the court says, or actually cites Arigato, thus the permitted baseline is the existing environment overlaid with such relevant authority as is permitted in the plan. Thus, if the activity permitted in the plan will create some adverse effects on the environment, that adverse effect does not count in the Section 104 or 105 assessments. It is part of the baseline in the sense that it is deemed to be already affected. Or if you like, it is not a relevant adverse effect. The consequence that only other or further adverse effects emanating from the proposal under consideration are brought into account. It submitted it would not be helpful to apply the permitted baseline in this case. It's of limited usefulness and it would only apply to be applicable to one third of the site, which is most of the site is zoned rural. Even in the Neansland, subject to the application, the permitted baseline to the freight hub is artificial and distorts what would usually be achieved in that zone because of the application of activities at a scale and intensity proposed in the notice of requirement that was never intended or possible in the area. It does not represent an accurate or realistic benchline of activities anticipated there. This operates to downplay the true effects of the proposal by manipulating the effects envelope. This approach is particularly inappropriate as it specifically downplays significant amenity effects that KiwiRail has made no attempt to internalise in the notice of requirement. The underlying planning environment is more useful to inform the panel as to what the district plan provides may occur on application of the site and surrounding properties, rather than being adverse effects that the panel should ignore. And I just want to stop, and I have seen reference, and it is bugging me because I haven't managed to find the answer in the documents, but about the extent to which acoustic effects from trains are excluded from the plan. And I'm not sure whether there's reference to a rule or something that I'm missing, but I just thought I'd, if there is a connection there, then obviously application of the permitted baseline or operation of the rules in the district plan in relation to trains, if there are any, may be something that the panel should look at. It doesn't necessarily need to adopt a permitted baseline if that's how they're controlled. And in my submission, the
I think the analysis goes like this. Whether this project happens or not, there will be increased traffic on the North Island trunk line. Within the existing corridor, there is a designation. So the effects of that are already allowed by the district plan, because running along that corridor would not be a breach of the district plan. That's, as I understand it, the analysis.
Thank you for enlightening me on that, sir. I haven't been able to find that anywhere in the documents that I was ploughing through.
I stand corrected by the council or KiwiRail's lawyers about that, but that's my understanding of the analysis. So that effectively Dr. Charles is saying these corridors have unlimited noise generating or are unlimited noise generation authorizations for rail traffic. Of course, practically speaking, they're not unlimited because they wouldn't be used continuously, but that's the theory. So any supplemental movement would not be calculated in this assessment.
Okay, thank you. And I probably shouldn't just start questioning you about aspects of that, sir. The extent to which the North Main Trunk Line is to be relocated, I think Mr. Lloyd has raised as an issue, and also there's obviously it's a bit of a chicken before the egg question of if the freight hub was established, whether it would result in the increase in frequency and number of trains in that area in relation to noise.
Yes. I suppose the counterfactual would be, so let's say it's in Longburn, you'd get a lot more traffic along Bunnythorpe as a consequence because it became a more intensive hub and no one could do anything about it. So there's a certain built-in noise envelope from the trunk line now because it's designated corridor.
Okay, that's very useful. I just thought I needed to put trains in there because I hadn't managed to figure out how they worked with the permitted baseline, but I will be corrected. The underlying planning, so in my submission, the underlying...
I'll just check. Commissioner Sweetman, is that your understanding of how the analysis is going?
Yes, I believe so.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. It's also useful to understand the reasonable expectations of those...
I'll just interrupt again. I think the council for Kiwi Rail and Ms Bell were probably looking at rule 6.2.6.2, exclusion from noise control rules, which is in the plan as well.
Thank you. So there's an exclusionary rule as well.
Right. So
yeah.
To the extent that the exclusionary rule is being applied or relied on for that, my submission would be that obviously there is no obligation for the panel to consider the permitted baseline, and that the increased acoustic effects or effects of trains is going to occur at an unanticipated level when the rule was enacted, and that should rightly be considered as an adverse effect of the freight hub. I think that's probably as far as I would take that. It's totally discretionary as to whether that plan, that rule is applied in the way that it should, and I hope that my friend for Palmerston North City Council will make submissions on that point, because Mr. Lloyd has certainly raised it in his evidence.
Are you saying it's discretionary because of the provision in Section 104 that makes it discretionary?
No, I'm just saying that application of the permitted baseline, if it forms part of the rules that are allowed in the plan, would be discretionary. The panel has no obligation to apply the permitted baseline. Application of the permitted baseline and the designation is discretionary. There's no law or statute either way as to whether it can be applied. So it's the panel's discretion as to whether it seeks to apply those rules.
Well, there's an express discretion in Section 104, but we're not dealing
with
104.
We're not dealing with 104, so there's no corresponding obligation to exclude those effects.
There's a discretion to exclude those effects in 104.
Yes, but there's no corresponding provision.
There's no corresponding provision, so do you return back to Arigato, which says an effect in the environment excludes that which is already permitted?
Well, that's whether the permitted baseline is applied. Arigato has decided in relation to 104, which is in resource consents. There's a discretion, the courts have said there's a discretion as to whether it applies on resource consents. So that is entirely for the panel to consider whether it finds the permitted baseline helpful in this case or whether it doesn't. The council's evidence, to some extent, I think, has been that application of the NEANS rules or permitted baseline is unhelpful and not appropriate. And I guess my extended submission, based on the really useful comments of Commissioner Sweetman and yourself, would be that also you should be looking at whether the exclusion rule for train noise, which would otherwise be part of the permitted baseline, is something that you should be just happily carrying over, or whether the intensity, scale, frequency, accumulation of train noise in the freight hub area results in effects which should be considered on their own bat, that they shouldn't be discounted or removed from any effects assessments as a result of that.
I guess my question is this. Whether we like it or not, the main trunk line on a best projection is going to get busier. And so people living next to a railway line can expect that as a reasonable projection. What's different about this is all the shunting and other components that are additional to that, and the extent to which it becomes the locus of train travel as opposed to simply becomes a destination as opposed to just a through place. And I guess it's pretty hard to unpack all of that, isn't it, really?
It is hard to unpack, and this will I'll attempt to. It might result in showing some deficiencies in my understanding of the project, but my understanding is that there's the existing mainline trunk and the aspects of, under an existing designation. That needs to be realigned as part of this project, and potentially either another designation sought for the realignment, or it's included
it, yeah,
in this.
Yeah. It's within it.
It's within it. Okay. So if it's within that, then I think you are probably limited to considering the difference in the effects of the... Well, considering what the effects of the proposal are. So if the proposal is going to result in increased frequency, which in this area, not just along the entire main freight line or North Trunk line, then I think that it's very fair to consider if KiwiRail's predictions are correct and the rail or the freight hub is going to result in, you know, the uptake and use of rail, and these trains are going to be coming to the freight hub. In my submission, that's an effect that is connected to the freight hub in relation to, particularly when considering the amenity of the people next to it. If it was somewhere else along the main line, then, you know, that would be an amenity effect for the people there. But to in my mind, to develop a freight hub which is dependent on trains coming and going to service the freight, and then discount or remove the effect of the noise of those and vibration of those trains seems like it skews the assessment in a way that means that you're not understanding the true effects of the whole activity.
Yes.
They should be included. They're related. And in my submission, they should be part of it.
Does Dr. Charles exclude it?
Yes. He excludes it. He says he hasn't undertaken an acoustic assessment that includes those. They've been excluded the whole way through. And then you'll see in the conditions, and I am coming to this a bit later, but you'll see in the conditions that in the operational limits and also in the operational limits, those limits exclude train noise from the NIMT.
Yeah,
So at the moment, where Dr. Fox and Dr. Whittle are standing, they have absolutely no idea whether, you know, putting the shoe on the other foot, they have no idea that the limits and the conditions are actually going to be the noise that they experience, because all these other things, traffic noise, perimeter traffic noise, and train noise, has been taken out. But the very nature of the activity that the notice of requirement is for. It's that intermodal, those two transport routes. So it seems very unusual that the effects of those have been discounted, and to an extent where there's no document that actually specifies what those effects are. I think that was Mr. Lloyd's concern in his evidence as well.
I understand that. I get the
Yeah. Sorry if it took a while to get there. No,
that's helpful.
Yeah. On the lap stage, Dr. Whittle and Fox seek the statutory default lap stage of 5 years, and the Environment Courts recognise this as being provided for in 184, as being the term recognised by Parliament as being the appropriate period for a party to invoke a designation. They request the statutory norm apply. It's not necessary to complete construction or give effect to the proposal. It's not necessary to complete all of the construction, I must say, and the construction that we're talking about for the first phase is 2 to 3 years, so that can be managed within that. It's also not necessary to complete construction in order to give effect to a proposal. But it does require Kiwi Rail to make a start, an extension to the lapse sort if required. And it's accepted that the panel can exercise its discretion in this regard. The Environment Court in Better Family Trust considered a request for a lapse period of 20 years, and this was cited in Council for Kiwi Rail's submissions in opening. But they appear to have misapplied it. In applying the discretion, it's the need to balance the interests of requiring authority and the interests with the directly affected landowners that's at the heart of this test. Kiwi Rail focus on certainty for businesses who might be enticed to invest in the vicinity due to the designation, but it ignores the toll on property owners whose homes and lives will be adversely affected by the designation. While Kiwi Rail may have acquired 41% of the properties within the notice of requirement, it's overlooked the many significantly affected properties that sit outside the designation footprint and will not be acquired as part of the process. For these people, a 10 or 15-year lapse period is a 10 or 15-year sentence living in limbo and experiencing the stress and uncertainty until at some point the project is developed, and then they will be subjected to long-term open-ended construction and operational effects. Kiwi Rail and the Council take a differing approach to certainty. Kiwi Rail contends the 15-year period in the notice of requirement sends a clear message and creates certainty for everyone, whereas Council and submitters see it as prolonging the uncertainty. In Hernan and others versus Vector Gas, the Environment Court applied Better to decline the application by Vectra to extend a lap period to 10 years. Rejecting Vector's argument that a longer designation provided certainty for affected landowners and community, and imposed 5 years on the basis that a greater certainty would be attained by a shorter period. This view is supported by Dr. Whittle and Fox and confirmed by Council's expert, including their economic expert, Mr. Vuletich, who says, given the large number of businesses, public sector organisations and households whose further plans depend on the outcome of this project, I recommend that the lapse period be kept as short as reasonably possible. Other factors that support a shorter lapse period are that the application's been advanced in haste and Kiwi Rail now seeks time to work out many issues, such as transport connections, consultation with iwi, or actually engagement with iwi full stop, detailed assessments, site assessments, etc. In my submission, some of this should have at least or could have properly occurred in advance of it seeking the notice of requirement. Bunnythorpe is at significant risk of social and planning blight for residents both in and out of the designated area. This is exacerbated by uncertainty as to the severity and duration of the adverse effects on properties outside the notice of requirement and the lack of an outline development plan which actually cements what people will see and experience. A long lapse period imposes controls on the use of land within the notice of requirement and will adversely affect the ability to sell and price realised for properties outside of the notice of requirement area that have been identified as being affected. And I'll just say there, I know property values aren't to be considered under the RMA, but the case law on that does actually require that, or the premise for the case law of it is that people shouldn't double dip as to what the effects are. And in this case, because the court said that the effects are generally considered under amenity and you wouldn't want to double count those. But in this case, it's actually very difficult to determine what the effects are on a particular property because there's not the details provided. So there's not a risk of double dipping, it's a risk of actually not having those effects considered at all, or considered at all, and it's that uncertainty that creates difficulty. KiwiRail has a history of leaving properties abandoned to become derelict while it decides what to do. And this fuels further blight, and there's some examples of that, properties around the country. Long lapse periods increase the risk of designations going stale. They reference long superseded standards and practices, and in this case they're potentially going to be referencing the RMA, which will be superseded legislation. That's going to mean that, well, that would make a real difficulty in how it's applied. It's going to contain conditions that won't properly address relevant effects in a manner expected at the time that they were implemented. In this case, it has to survive up until the final operation date is 2051.
Is it possible to set a lapse date that says the earlier of 5 years if a property is not acquired, and otherwise 10 years, say, for example?
I would say you could, because the panel has discretion as to how, obviously whether it extends a lap date, and in my submission, the terms on which it extends that would also mean that something like that could be considered.
Because that would be a way of balancing the interests of KiwiRail to have some certainty about the build-out and some certainty for landowners that their property is either free of the designation or not.
Yes.
Within a shorter period.
I think also, I'll come to it, but also what is important is where properties aren't acquired, that the designation actually imposes some quite stringent rules on the use of those properties.
Absolutely.
So something like a five-year clause would give give KiwiRail a good shot at acquiring those and those processes to occur.
Hmm.
If not, but I think in Dr. Whittle and Fox's view, anything that brings the lapse period to a more
down.
Realistic date is probably going to be supported.
Hmm.
In response to the reasons cited by KiwiRail for requesting a 15-year lapse period, it's noted they cite Transmission Gully proposal and the East-West Link proposal as being similar projects that were afforded a 15-year term. And in my submission, these are just simply not comparable projects. They were both called in by Roads of National Significance by the Minister. They were fast-tracked and they were granted full set of resource consents at the same time and necessary plan changes subsequently by the Environment Court. The Auckland City Rail Link is a better comparison of a project, albeit far more complicated and stretching far further. It contains successive designations, and I haven't managed to add them up across their website, but contains successive designations for sections across urban Auckland. They all contain a 10-year lapse date for delivery across all sections, despite 20 years initially being sought. Ms. Bell's contention that uncertainty caused by the freight hub is no different than any other zone change, in my submission, fails to appreciate the extreme stress in the designation process puts on those affected, as it removes property owners' rights in favour of the requiring authority. And also it places those restrictions on land subject to a notice of requirement. The designation, compulsory acquisition, and the ultimate uncertainty is the level of design included in the ODP, add to that stress, as well as the inability for residents to properly participate or have any real ability to change what is included in an ODP. They're sort of out of their hands at that point. In terms of amenity, obviously Section 7C of the Resource Management Act provides for consideration of amenity values. Section 7 directs the panel to have particular regard to these, to the maintenance and enhancement of these values. They're defined in the Act as being those natural and physical qualities or characteristics of an area that contribute to people's appreciation of its pleasantness, aesthetic coherence, and cultural and recreational attributes. Dr. Whittle and Fox, like many of the other submitters that you will have heard, are concerned about the likely and potential significant effects of the freight hub, but are uncertain as to what the precise effects that they experience will be. The remaining residents, which are those outside the proposed designation, will be subjected to significant effects, particularly in respect of amenity effects. So the traffic, noise, vibration, dust, light, visual, and some quite substantial construction effects. If the freight hub is developed on the conditions proposed, it's highly likely that it will significantly degrade their environment. One aspect of this is the freight hub is relatively unique in its desire for 24 hours a day, 7 day a week, intensive, constant industrial activity, and the potential scale of those effects. KiwiRail has not offered the usual respite in the evenings or weekends or holidays, which is often put forward by applicants, to mitigate the effects of disruptive exposure to significant amenity effects. And even where the long-term construction standard is used, it's not uncommon to provide nearby residents with some sort of break. Activities where this is not possible, one example is that Palmerston North is familiar with is wind farms or large-scale continued quarrying, are usually subjected to far closer scrutiny as to mechanisms of monitoring, reporting, conditions, restricting operational activity to certain times, site management, compliance testing and the like, aimed at protecting residents from both the long-term construction and permanent operational effects. There have been no attempts by KiwiRail to internalise the effects of the notice of requirement within its site or to accept any constraints on the use of the site in order to reduce cross-boundary effects to an acceptable, safe or appropriate level. Mr. Lloyd's comments on this are supported. It's not unreasonable to expect KiwiRail to largely manage the effects of its activities on site or for there to be some control at the boundary of the designation. If that cannot occur, then land can be included in the designation where it is reasonably necessary to allow for the safe operation of the freight hub. This would be a common sense approach that would enable KiwiRail to acquire land to protect neighbouring residents from unreasonable levels of noise or other emissions such as dust, and assure that its neighbours are not unduly affected or burdened by its operations. But it's declined to do so, citing costs and preference not to sterilise the land. And there's some discussion as to whether the effects that may occur on those lands actually sterilise it anyway. The expectation that the remaining residents bear the brunt in the cost of the off-site effects is illustrated by the buffer zone. It's unclear what this is designed to protect, given that it comprises of occupied private dwellings that my understanding is KiwiRail has no intention of acquiring. In my submission, KiwiRail should control the effects at its boundary, another example which provides an unfair advantage to KiwiRail over residents is the exclusion of special audio characteristics, the way in which noise predictions and proposed conditions focus on occupied dwellings, for example, the application of the construction noise standard, and the notional boundary, not the site boundary, of the property, which is the usual approach to noise measurements in district plans. KiwiRail's mitigation conditions aim at making affected properties and homes habitable, which in my submission is probably the very lowest form of what you'd want a home for. While Category C acknowledges noise at a levels where many may not be, and that's just simply unacceptable. I mean, what do you do when your home cannot be inhabited as a result of noise? There's nothing in the conditions that says what you do then. It's just identified as an effect. This approach downplays and ignores the impact on rural residential properties, as noted by the Environment Court in Westwind. And Judge Dwyer there noted that the definition of amenity values in Section 2 of the RMA does not limit them to what can be perceived inside only houses. Judge Dwyer in Motorimu, which obviously Chair will be familiar with, emphasised the impact of amenity issues on rural properties. People in rural properties enjoy all parts of their properties and can have extensive views over the landscape from some locations. This is a community of people who work for their land. There can be little doubt that four people on such properties sharing the landscape with a wind farm will be an everyday reality. And in my submission, Judge Dwyer's comments are equally relevant to the Bunnythorpe today. COVID-19 restrictions have meant people are confined to their homes and have gained a further sense of appreciation of their property's outdoor areas, making gardens and paddocks, not just their dwellings, more pertinent and important than ever.
Yeah, that's certainly true.
If you couldn't escape the noise, you'd very quickly get very upset. I'm just checking. Well,
we've all gained a more appreciation of our dwellings and gardens.
And our gardens.